Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Huckenberry today. Thank you for listening. In this hour, a dollar doesn't go very far these days, but it does go a lot further in some parts of the country than in others. We're going to talk about how cost of living impacts the decisions we make about where to live and when to move, plus an estimated $575 million make up the LA Clippers NBA franchise. What could happen to it now that the world has had a weekend to digest the racist comments of owner Donald Sterling? And the marathon that is Overcoming Grief, the story of how one widow of a fallen soldier turned to a running group as a way to cope for her and dozens of others. But first, we go to the South, where violent tornadoes struck several states this weekend, at least 17 people dead in the path of the twisters. Arkansas reported some of the worst damage, with extensive damage reported to several towns. More storms are expected in Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Kim Severson is the Atlanta bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. She's covered severe weather like this extensively throughout her career. But these storms, which came during the night, can be among the most unpredictable.
It's the scariest thing. I've covered a lot of tornadoes in my time down here. And during the day, people feel at least like they have something of a fighting chance. Most people are awake. They're able to get into shelters or see the storm coming. When they come in the evening like this, it's a long night when you're waiting to figure out exactly which of your neighbors were hit and how much damage is done, particularly in smaller communities where people know each other, and a tornado can really do widespread damage to a small community.
Kim Severson, do we know anything about the quality of the early warning system here? Were people aware that they were coming even though it was nighttime? Did they have time to get to safer ground or get out of the path of the twisters?
Well, lots of Twitter feeds went out. Certainly people this day and age are not listening for sirens so much anymore. They're watching social media or they're watching the TV news, and the advances in weather forecasting are such that they can pinpoint when and how a tornado is going to hit with amazing accuracy. So I saw my Twitter feed a lot of immediate warnings, take shelter now. I follow a lot of people who are meteorologists and government officials in Arkansas. So it was amazing, the flurry of Twitter feeds that came out. So one presumes that worked. I think we'll probably find out more today.
When does the tornado season normally start? You mentioned it's been a light tornado year, despite the size of the devastation this morning.
Right. The 2014 tornado season only saw its first fatality on Sunday in North Carolina when a tornado came through. 11-month-old boy was killed on Sunday when a house fell on his family. There are about 200 homes hit in Greenville. That was a really early, rather a later storm season for us down here for tornadoes. I don't know if you remember in 2011, there were just devastating storms, killed more than 300 people in Alabama. Of course, Joplin in 2011. 2012 was a terrible season as well. So this has been a surprisingly light season, but we are certainly bracing for more storms to come through here in the next couple of days.
Kim Severson, Atlanta bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
We take you now to the ground in Baxter Springs, Kansas, where an estimated 60 to 70 homes have been destroyed this weekend by a devastating tornado. Now, Baxter Springs is just 15 miles from Joplin, Missouri, where we all remember the tornado that ravaged that town in May of 2011. Shannon Halligan is there covering the story. Hello, Shannon.
Hi, Dad.
What's the latest? What are you seeing?
Well, I just talked to a family, woman and her husband, who have five kids, the youngest 9 weeks old, and they barely made it out of their home, just with a few bumps and bruises. But it's really amazing because this tornado just went straight through their home. It was about three blocks wide, so a lot of people affected by this. And like you said, 60 to 70 homes, as well as possibly 20 to 25 businesses that were destroyed by this tornado that hit at around 5:45 Central Time yesterday.
Shannon, does that mean that a lot of people managed to get out of the way? I'm wondering what the early warning system was like there.
Yeah, well, I'm talking to the sheriff in Cherokee County here yesterday. He said that they were prepared for the past couple of days because they knew that this system was going to be a dangerous one. So a lot of people were kind of keeping an eye out. Luckily, it did hit around 5:45, so it wasn't in the middle of the night. So people did have a chance to, you know, try and get to safety. And the sirens were going off, but still a lot of people, they don't really believe that it's going to hit until it actually does, even though Joplin is 25 minutes away from here, and that's where we stayed last night. So a lot of people saying brings back a lot of memories from Joplin.
And have storm protection infrastructure aspects been beefed up since Joplin? There were also the horrible tornadoes in Oklahoma last year. Afterward, lots of calls for more storm shelters, stronger schools, stronger buildings. Has any of that stuff happened around Baxter Springs in the area there?
You know, I think that these homes did have basements, whereas in Oklahoma, I think there wasn't as much of a prevalence of basements there. But here, I think that a lot of the homes are older. There were some homes that are, you know, older buildings from the 1870s even. But even brick buildings were just turned to rubble in some of these cases. So in terms of building structure, I think that with this, they'll continue to rebuild with stronger homes. But before this, I don't think that was something that people made an effort to change ahead of time.
Shannon Halligan is a reporter for KSHB on the ground there for us in Baxter Springs. Shannon, thank you.
Thanks, Dad.
As expected, the United States announced a new round of sanctions against Russia earlier today. The Treasury Department is imposing new sanctions on 7 Russian government officials, including 2 members of President Putin's inner circle. They'll be subject to an asset freeze and a U.S. visa ban. 17 other companies are also being targeted, as will certain exports related to military technology.
The goal here is not to go after Mr. Putin personally. The goal is to change his calculus with respect to how the current actions that he's engaging in Ukraine could have an adverse impact on the Russian economy over the long haul.
President Obama there speaking at a news conference in the Philippines earlier today. The European Union also is turning the economic screws. On the ground, those feeling the pressure are increasingly the press. Natalia Antalava has been covering the story for the BBC from eastern Ukraine. She is now safely back in London. And Natalia, I say safely for good reason. What happened to you there?
Well, I think what happened to us is something that has happened to many others, and I think it fades in comparison to what's happening to the local residents in eastern Ukraine. We had an incident when we went into the city of Slavyansk, which is the most militarized town in the region. It's under full control of the pro-Russian rebel separatist forces, and when we tried to speak to some of the locals who were not necessarily very pro-Russian, we were stopped by 5 men with guns, who had guns held up to us, accused of being American spies, accused of spreading propaganda and lies and rumors, threatened quite seriously, and finally we were let go. But as I said, this is just one example of how volatile the situation on the ground is. So for Ukrainians on the ground, it continues to be extremely dangerous. And I think many people are very frustrated with the inability of the Ukrainian army to go in and to change the situation on the ground. And at the same time, many people, the division is very deep, the situation is very polarized, and I've spoken to plenty of people who actually welcome these pro-Russian rebels and think that, you know, they are doing the right thing.
From over on this side of the Atlantic, Natalia Antalava, senior administration officials at the White House said earlier today that arming the Ukrainian army, sending American weapons there, wouldn't do them any good in facing down pro-Russian forces. Is that the sense there?
There is probably a good reason for saying that, because I don't think it comes. I mean, we have seen examples of Ukrainian army being under-equipped and not very well equipped. But I don't think this is their main problem. The main problem is that it feels very much like they're very, very nervous about creating a situation when President Putin will accuse them of provoking violence and then will bring in troops. I mean, we've heard Vladimir Putin say openly that if the Ukrainian army opens fire at peaceful demonstrators and Russia continuously refers to this pro-Russian militiamen as peaceful demonstrators, then he will bring in the troops. And if he brings in the troops that are massing on the other side of the border, then Ukraine has a war on its hands that it's not able to win. So I think the Ukrainian army is being very careful about provoking Putin in any sort of way. And I have to say, I get a very clear sense of deja vu of the war between Russia and Georgia in 2008, when the run-up to that war was exactly almost identical with the Russian troops gathered on the border between Georgia and Russia for the so-called military exercises, and this continuous build-up of tension in the rhetoric from the Kremlin, from Tbilisi, and also in the rhetoric on the Russian media, until finally the Georgians went into Thassa-Ossetia enclave to conduct this, what they call the anti-terrorist operation, and Russia used that as a pretext to bring in the troops. And I think this is exactly what the Ukrainian side is trying to avoid. But the question that supporters of Kyiv on the ground are asking is, well, what is the solution? Because if the Ukrainians do nothing, then the rebels will continue taking over the government buildings. I mean, we saw another incident today. Yesterday, a TV tower in the city of Donetsk was taken over. Ukrainian TV was taken off air, replaced by Russian television. This morning, we had an assassination attempt against the mayor of the city of Kharkiv, who is in a critical condition after a two-hour-long surgery now. So we have a situation which is escalating, which is extremely serious, and to which no one seems to have a solution.
If American military aid won't help, and indeed might play into Russian plans to escalate the situation, there is, of course, the issue of sanctions, which I mentioned. Is there any sense on the ground in Ukraine that these gradual American and European sanctions against more and more and more Russian oligarchs or cronies or allies of Putin will do any good? We're still not hitting the energy sector. We're still not hitting Russian banks very hard, the financial sector. Is there any sense that this will help the situation?
I think the sense on the pro-Ukrainian side, in pro-Kiev side, on the ground in eastern Ukraine, is that it's too little, too slowly, too late. Many pro-Kiev supporters that I'm speaking to on the ground are saying that there is this sense of, you know, appeasement from the U.S. administration that is very, very disappointing to them. At the same time, the pro-Russian side in eastern Ukraine will take the sanctions as a sign, as a proof for what they see as America interfering and America being behind this whole movement in the government in Kyiv. So, of course, you know, I expect this will just antagonize everyone further. I think the big question is how much will it hit Russia? These sanctions do look more serious. We at least have two recognizable figures in the Kremlin, in the administration, that will be targeted. But again, I think in terms of resolution of the conflict, I think I don't see how that will achieve that.
Natalia Antalava has just returned to London from eastern Ukraine, where she's been reporting on the increasingly tense confrontation between the Ukrainian government and pro-Ukraine forces and pro-Russian rebels in the eastern part of that country. Natalia Antalava, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Now, you wouldn't necessarily expect us to recap this weekend's NBA action, but right now the NBA needs to address the huge fallout caused by these alleged remarks by LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling.
You could do whatever you want. You could sleep with him, you could bring him in, you could do whatever you want. The little I ask you is not to promote it on that and not to bring him to my games.
When ignorant folks want to advertise their ignorance, you don't really have to do anything, you just let them talk.
I believe everybody was affected by what took place. I don't believe it was just the Clippers.
The audio recording posted by TMZ is truly offensive and disturbing.
There's no room for Donald Sterling in our league.
Here with us to talk about how the league might and should respond is our friend and sports commentator, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, hello.
How are you doing?
Great. Like I said, the world has had a weekend to digest these comments. A lot of the sort of backward-looking reporting about Donald Sterling is anyone who knew him wasn't surprised because he has a long history. The thing is, most people didn't know who he was before this weekend.
Most people weren't paying attention to the Los Angeles Clippers. He's already settled a housing discrimination lawsuit that claimed that he refused to rent to African-Americans. So that's in the past as well. Elgin Baylor, who some of you guys may, your name you may recognize as one of the greats in the NBA, was also a longtime GM for the Clippers. And he had a lawsuit against him for years about being about creating a pervasive and ongoing racist attitude. And also, he wanted to sort of shape his team to have a Southern white coaching poor black boys. That was the framing that Elgin Baylor allegedly said that Donald Sterling had for the Clippers. So his racist attitudes and comments have long existed.
Especially problematic in the NBA, where I think 70 or 75% of the players are black.
It's an overwhelmingly African-American league.
Overwhelmingly. Sure. And so is the team. And that's to be expected. And here's a white owner or any owner making remarks like this makes a lot of guys just not want to play there. I mean, Kobe Bryant said, I wouldn't play there. Easy for him to say because he's not on the team, but
at the end of the day, it's going to be bad for business for the Los Angeles Clippers. Who's going to want to go to the games? Who's going to want to buy the merchandise? Who's going to want to support Donald Sterling when they know he's a clear racist, according to what we've seen?
So the leadership of the NBA now, which has a brand new commissioner, right?
Correct.
The new commissioner of the NBA is under a lot of pressure, not only to act, but to act very quickly. And one of the questions swirling around is, what can the NBA actually do to Donald Sterling? And we don't actually really know.
Well, part of the reason we don't actually really know is that the NBA owners have a very close – their rules and the rules that govern them, we don't know and we don't have access to and we will not have access to. The new commissioner, Adam Silver, has been very clear that they're going to investigate and act swiftly. So they've been moving swiftly. So what does this look like and what does this mean? Well, the first thing they have to determine is what – is the voice on the tape actually him? Has it been altered? So they have to get a voice recognition specialist to come in and determine if it's Donald Sterling or not. I think the second thing, and beyond that, they have to get the tape and get the original recording from TMZ. Based on these are private entities, there's no legal subpoena power that the NBA has over the TMZ. So there's a hurdle there that exists. I think the other thing that they have to remember is that the NBA can't kick him out. From all that we know, they cannot kick him out as an owner.
Not like baseball, where baseball owners can get together and vote out an owner. My understanding, and we don't know for sure, but the reporting on the NBA Constitution is that an owner can only be voted out if he can't pay his bills.
Correct.
Not for being a terrible person.
Yeah, he has to. If he's able to do all the things that he's supposed to do financially, he can stay in. And that's really, I think, where there's going to be a lot of outrage. I think there's going to be incredible calls for Donald Sterling to get out of the league. He's already agreed to not be at the game. He wasn't at the game last night. And it's likely that he won't be at any more of the games
Year. Does this mean that it may wind up being up to fans to vote with their feet and refuse to come to games? Can players, they're in the playoffs, so you heard the words of Doc Rivers, the coach, saying our protest is to play and play well. I'm thinking of Jackie Robinson when I hear him say things like that. Can players eventually refuse to appear at Clippers games in L.A.?
I think the big question, I mean, folks like Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali, those folks fought for access within these major sports. Nowadays, it's really what is the quality of life of players in the NBA and at all levels of sports. But the players did have a conversation about boycotting the game. They talked about that, and I'm sure that was a heated discussion across the league. Other players were wearing black socks and black armbands in support of the Clippers players. So I think this issue is just starting to begin.
And you have thought a lot about this. What do you think players should do? You played college sports. You played Division I football yourself. If you were on that team, what would be your vote in the locker room?
I mean, you draw a line between what's happening in Northwestern, where they're voting on a union, what's happening with allowing gay athletes, where you're creating a better culture for athletes in sports. I think right now these players need to take a stand. They need to take a stand that's similar to the way those players at Northwestern are taking a stand and say, we're not going to stand this, and we're not actually going to go out there and dance around and show ourselves for this racist owner. It's tough. They put in a lot of hard work, but imagine the sacrifice. They make millions of dollars. Imagine the sacrifice and what could come potentially positive out of that sacrifice.
One of the sort of downsides of the prospect of forcing Donald Silver to sell is that he bought the Clippers for basically nothing, and it's now worth about $600 million. I mean, somebody would have to write him that check.
There are probably an incredible amount of owners, which I'm sure Magic Johnson would not shy at the opportunity to buy the Los Angeles Clippers right there in his home city.
Can Donald Sterling be lowballed in this case? I mean, if he's under duress to sell?
I think there's going to also be – I agree with that. There could be a push for that, and there's also going to be – are those contracts based on civil rights law? They're creating a sort of a dangerous environment for the players. Can they void those contracts? I think that's still an open question, whether they can get out of those contracts. And you might see some of these players, including Doc Rivers, the coach, leaving and going to other teams.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports commentator, talking about Donald Sterling and his comments that came to light this weekend. Later in the hour, how much can a dollar buy where you live? What kind of an apartment could you rent for maybe $1,000? Or what kind of house can you get for $300,000? Your responses have been pouring in.
This is Larry Bush. I live near Tampa, Florida. We can buy a 44-ounce soda for a dollar. We can rent a 1,500-square-foot condo for $1,000 per month. And in Tampa, we can buy a 3,000-square-foot house with a nice property for about $300,000.
Kate writes to us on Facebook, in the Bay Area, $1 for a cup of coffee at the 7-Eleven, not Starbucks, she adds, $1,000 for a one-bedroom basement apartment to share with 14 adults, and $300,000, a dilapidated shack on 10 square feet of land. Well, we want to hear from you in your town. What does a dollar, $1,000, $300,000 get for you? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE and be sure to follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway. We have more later this hour, so stay with us. Well, we've been thinking a lot about voting on the show here recently, like how to vote. But here's a question just as important. Who votes in America? The U.S. Census Bureau has brand new data looking at decades worth of voting patterns from across the country. And if you look inside the numbers, you can find some bad news and some good news for both Republicans and Democrats. Dante Cheney is director of the American Communities Project at American University and joins me to shed some light on what those numbers mean. Welcome back, Dante.
Oh, well, hey, it's good to be back.
Well, you've helped dive inside the numbers of the U.S. Census Bureau here. What do we know really about who votes and when?
Well, you know, these numbers are interesting to look at because they verify what everybody thinks, which is, you know, younger people, they don't vote in the same numbers. Even in places where they voted high numbers, they don't vote as high as older people vote. In District of Columbia, in this report, 70%, 69.9% of younger people vote. That's 18 to 29-year-olds. But when you get 30 and older, it's 78%. That's a pretty big jump.
And as voter turnout overall drops off, the youngs, as they call them, drop off even faster.
Yeah, and that's something the Democrats really have in mind this year, because these numbers are for presidential. This census data was looking at presidential elections. When you look at midterms, the numbers drop really sharply for younger people. You know, it's a bit of a roller coaster. The numbers go up for Democrats, particularly younger voters in presidential years, and then fall. And they go up and they fall. And this has been, they keep getting these great numbers for presidential elections, and everybody's like, hey, the youth vote is back. And then midterms, it falls back down to where it's been before. Mm.
We can't have this discussion without acknowledging that in many states and jurisdictions throughout the country, there's a concerted effort to make voting harder. Early voting, weekend voting, absentee voting, a lot of different forms of voting, primarily Republican legislatures trying to make it harder to vote. What do the numbers tell us about turnout and outcome, or do they tell us anything?
Well, I mean, these numbers in particular don't tell us a lot about turnout and outcome so much, because these are the presidential years. But I think there are some clues in these numbers that I think are very interesting looking forward, because even with all those barriers that are being put up, and there are some high ones that have been put up in North Carolina, you know, you look at what's going on here, and when you have enough of a focus on a state, when it's intensely focused, you know, getting the vote out, you're going to get that turnout up, and that turnout helps Democrats. To me, it's when you look at these numbers, the one thing it says is the more kind of intense the election is, the more money spent, the more focus it's on the state, the higher the turnout is.
All right. So those are some of the age aspects of who votes. What about ethnic profile? What about Hispanic voters?
Yeah, that's one thing that really jumped out at me in this, because there's this big question about Texas in particular. I wrote about this recently, where Texas, the turnout's very low. Look, Texas is not a state that is competitive, I think, as we all know. I mean, it's a state where you start off, you know, when you're figuring out the map for 2016, you make it red right now, right? It's going to go sure. Republican. The question is, how long is that going to last? Because there's this big, huge Hispanic population in Texas. And if you look at it, it's extremely young. So actually, the ethnicity thing correlates here with the age thing. And as that group ages into voting, will that mean that Texas will get to be in play very quickly, like over the course of one or two elections? There's numbers in here that suggest that to me, because when you look at places like Nevada, which also has a large Hispanic population, their young person turnout is not very high, but much higher than it is in Texas. It's about 45% in Nevada. Young person turnout in Texas is only about 29%. So, you know, if you can get the intensity in Texas, get people wrapped up and interested, you might get the Hispanic vote coming out and coming out very fast, and you could see the state flip kind of quickly, I think.
Well, there might be some bad news for Democrats in the young voter aspect, but some bad news for Republicans in terms of Hispanic voters in Texas and elsewhere. To check out a map of the data, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. You can see an infographic of voter participation. Dante Cheney, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow was supposed to be the deadline for American-brokered peace talks between Israel and Palestine, but last week Israel called off the talks after Palestinian rival factions announced a united political front. Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, and Fatah, in charge of the West Bank, are now united.
What we're trying to do is repair our political system, is create an inclusive, pluralistic, democratic system, and at the same time get rid of a rift that has weakened the Palestinians and has been used against the Palestinians.
That's Hanan Ashrawi. She's a leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Now, Israel sees Hamas as a terrorist organization. The United States designates Hamas as a terrorist organization, and Israel says it will not negotiate with the newly allied government.
Now, we call upon the Palestinian leadership to reverse this negative decision, to annul this harmful agreement with Hamas. If they do so, we will be ready to return to negotiations immediately.
That's Mark Regev. He's a spokesperson for the Israeli government. So what's next? If a way forward can't be found, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, says he's ready to declare the West Bank under occupation and leave Israel with full responsibility over 2.5 million Palestinians living there. Fawaz Gurgis is author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World, and he's professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, and he joins me now. Professor, hello.
Hello.
Of swift reaction from the Israelis to this united front between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, the first question I had in my mind is, how did Hamas and the Palestinian Authority manage to join up after being at odds for so long?
Well, I mean, this is not the first attempt on the part of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. It's a marriage of convenience. I think Palestinian reconciliation is a priority. Hamas is a terrible position now as a result of the loss of Mohamed Morsi, the Egyptian president. The military government in Egypt has exerted considerable pressure on Hamas in the last 9 months. It has major problems of delivering the goods inside Gaza. It needs a way out. President Mahmoud Abbas basically has several hands to play. He would like to strengthen his position at home on the streets in the Palestinian territories. He's trying to improve his bargaining position vis-a-vis Israel. And also, I think the reality is, regardless of what you think of Hamas, you cannot have a viable peace process without basically Palestinian reconciliation. Even though the jury is still out, this is a priority, not only for the Palestinians, but also for any kind of prospects for Palestinian-Israeli peacemaking.
What does it mean if Mahmoud Abbas makes good on his threat after tomorrow and says the Palestinian Authority is no longer governing here in the West Bank, Israel, it belongs to you?
Well, I mean, we know that Israel is in a very precarious position. That the reality is, if the Palestinian Authority collapses tomorrow, Israel would be in charge of Palestinians' citizens and territories. on the West Bank. It will have to take care of Palestinian demands and needs and aspirations. And I would argue it would sharpen international pressure of Israel's occupation.
Now that Hamas is no longer acting alone in the Gaza Strip and is joined up with Fatah to govern all of the Palestinian territories, is there pressure on Hamas now to recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel, a condition that Netanyahu says is necessary to even begin talking again?
Yes, absolutely. Mahmoud Abbas has made it very clear that Hamas will accept the potential peace process. It would recognize Israel. It would renounce terrorism. Ironically, we have not heard from Hamas in the last few times that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority have tried to reconcile. Hamas was very quick to basically reject the terms. This time, Hamas has been silent. And this is very telling and very interesting. We have to wait and see. But I will argue that obviously Hamas has come to the reality of accepting what I call the nationalist terms that the Palestinians, basically most Palestinians, accept, almost 65% of a two-state solution.
Fawaz Gurgis is professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's the author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
So, what's a dollar worth to you?
Here in Salt Lake City, for a dollar, you could get a cup of yogurt, a candy bar, or 38 ounces of gasoline. For $1,000 in the city, you can rent an apartment of 1 to 2 beds and 1 bath. It probably would not include off-street parking, and it probably would not have a washer and dryer or dishwasher in the unit, although it may. For $300,000 in Salt Lake City, you can buy roughly a 3-bed, 2-bath house on about a tenth of an acre in a pleasant middle-class neighborhood.
Well, thanks to Laura there. From Pleasanton, California, we hear this about the San Francisco Bay Area. I could buy a Clif Bar, a candy bar, or a couple of pieces of in-season fruit or veggies for a dollar. I could maybe buy a small, older home in a lesser neighborhood or an apartment unit for $300,000 and call me with any rental for $1,000 a month within a 15-mile radius of here. I will take it.
Hi, this is Alina from Texas, and I have to say, $1,000 can get you a nice 2-bedroom, 2-bath apartment in a gated community, and $300,000 can get you a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom house with a yard and a 2-car garage.
And from Barbara in Honolulu, all is impossible in Hawaii, she says. Well, new data from the Commerce Department is putting a much finer point on how far a dollar goes where you live. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, a dollar buys the most goods and services in the state of Mississippi. And the least in my home of Washington, D.C., Hawaii comes in a close second where all things are impossible. But what does this data mean when it comes to how people value location and affordability in choosing where to live and whether or not to move? Joining me now is Daniel Shoag, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Well, you heard some of the responses from the listeners about what a dollar or $1,000 buys them in their communities, and Barbara from Honolulu saying all is impossible with a dollar where she lives. How do those comments strike you?
Well, I can empathize. I'm from Cleveland, and moving to Boston was kind of a sticker shock. And I think that the differences those people are speaking about are real and important when people decide where to live and work.
Well, we're used to, of course, it's no surprise that things are cheaper in Mississippi than they are in Washington, D.C. or downtown New York. That's not a surprise. But we're learning a lot more about why things cost so much less in places like Mississippi and what it means in terms of cost of living.
Yes. I mean, it's always been the case that some parts of the country have been more expensive than others. But those differences relative to the differences in incomes have grown a lot in the last couple decades. And a big driver of that has been growth in housing prices in certain places, housing and land. And so I think that's really what drives the big differences. Traded goods, so apples, price differences across places there are going to be relatively minor because those can be shipped. But housing is the big non-traded good that drives price differences.
And I guess the point is there that housing can't be moved around. Housing is where you live. I mean, that's sort of obvious. But, it used to be that we used to say, well, New York's expensive, but you make a lot more. Your salary is double what it is in Biloxi, so it all kind of works out.
Yeah, for most of U.S. history, people would move from the poorer parts of the country to the richer parts of the country. It was a really strong trend from sort of the earliest times that we have data. But the last few decades have actually seen sort of a reversal in that pattern. Instead of moving to, the richest parts of the country now, Boston or New York or San Francisco, we see people moving to sort of mid-wage places in Florida and Phoenix or Las Vegas. That's a big change.
And is all of this just sort of the traditional pattern of people moving out of the cities towards the suburbs and then the far suburbs because they can get better houses, or is there something more at work here?
Well, my research has looked at the effect of regulations in driving a lot of this. And, the actual cost, physical cost of building a house in Boston or in Texas is not that different. But the prices are very different. And the reason is because it's a lot harder legally to build in some of these cities. And that really drives up the price. I lived in an apartment building a few years ago with six stories. And, it was very expensive. And why didn't they build the seventh story? It would have been profitable. We certainly know how to build one more story. And the reason was just sort of the zoning codes didn't allow it. And that's become pretty pervasive in parts of the country.
So what does it mean then if wages aren't keeping up with rental prices and home prices? As soon as I read that, I thought, well, isn't that what empties out the middle of cities when people can't pay their rent anymore? Can't that turn cities into ghost towns?
Well, what you see is you start to see very different patterns across education, skill type of the people who are moving in. So sort of the highly educated or college educated workers continue to move to these places that are expensive but offer high wages because, sort of the increase in rent doesn't wipe out their gains. But what we really see is lower skilled workers or workers without a college degree are much more likely to move away and to be priced out of certain markets.
Is this gentrification on the national scale?
In parts of the country, we're seeing sort of parts of the country diverge from the rest of the country in terms of how educated the workforce is. And I think that this is playing a big role.
So, Daniel Shoag, where's the sweet spot then? We know it's not in New York. We know it's definitely not in Washington, D.C., where I live. In Mississippi, things are good and cheap, but wages probably aren't quite as high, and maybe they don't have the same kinds of jobs that they have in some of the big cities. So what's a place that's like maybe the sweet spot right now in all of America where you get the best bang for your buck and the best house and the best job?
Well, I mean, everyone has different preferences. And so my training as an economist is to say, well, people make the right choices. And it actually seems like, we see people moving to places that offer them good deals. And so the parts of the country that are growing are places that offer, even if they don't have the highest wages, they offer the best, sort of the best bundle of things, prices and wages and space. So
everybody's moving to Phoenix.
Well, I've only been there once, but it was lovely. Shockingly cold.
Colder than you thought. But there's a good chance that a dollar or even 10 bucks in Phoenix, hey, it goes a lot further than it does where I live on 16th Street in the nation's capital. That's for sure. Well, that's Daniel Shoag. Yeah. He's assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks.
Well, we've been asking you how far your dollar goes. Sarah writes on Facebook, in Oklahoma City, $1 for some candy, $1,000 for a nice 2 or 3 bedroom apartment with amenities, and for $300,000, a new 2,500 square foot 4 bedroom, 2 bath with high end finishes in a gated community. And this from Austin, Texas. You can buy a bottle of water for less than a dollar. You can rent a nice-ish 2-bedroom apartment for $1,000. For $300,000, you could buy a 5-bedroom house on the east side with that, or a nice 3-bedroom in a safe neighborhood. Not bad in Austin, Texas. Tell us how far your dollar stretches where you live at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. This is The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Captain John Hallett of the 5-2 Striker Brigade combat team was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. That left his wife Lisa with 3 young children and unimaginable grief. Here's Lisa talking about how she began to cope.
Me running right now is the same as running when John was alive, or running after he died. There's no difference. I mean, my heartache's different. What I can listen to on the radio is different. But my identity as a runner doesn't change. The purpose behind why I run changes. But running still is putting one foot in front of the other, owning a distance, and pushing forward.
That's Lisa Hallett running the trails near her home in DuPont, Washington. But she stopped running just on her own because more than three dozen families in the Hallett's Brigade had also lost loved ones. Lisa instead helped create a running club with other widows in her community. Her husband's unit lost 41 soldiers in Afghanistan. The club called Wear Blue, Run to Remember has now grown from a dozen women to hundreds of people running to honor the memory of loved ones lost in combat. Lisa's story of resilience is the subject of a new documentary by Glenn Anderson. He's a senior producer for the BBC based in Washington, D.C., and he's here today to talk about the film and the community of runners that grew out of loss. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Your film is sort of in two parts. It's Lisa's home life, grieving and trying to rebuild for a lost husband that she was very close to. And then it's the part of her life that's running, and those two things sort of become interconnected.
Absolutely. And, you know, the story is really about how this community was formed. And it wasn't just Lisa's loss, and it wasn't just the loss of John Hallett, but the unit he was in lost 41 men. So this was a community that very close to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in DuPont, Washington, that they were hurting. They came together and they found solace in running. And while the story that I focus on is Lisa's story, she's our character, it's a vehicle to bring us more into how a community came together, found an outlet for these stressors, the most difficult stressors you could even imagine, losing a spouse to war. And out of it, they found mutual support, they found friendship, they found accomplishment, and it helped the healing process. It helped this community, and Lisa's one example of someone who thrived.
The running club really kind of accomplished a community and healing in a way that the casualty assistance officers, the military, as hard as they try and as effective as they may be, never really could.
It's different. You know, they have different tasks ahead of them. The casualty assistance officers are there to help with those practical concerns and to be that liaison to all the military stuff that needs to be done. But when they go home, there's still a role to fill. And what's interesting about the casualty assistance officer featured in the film, Fred DeQuina, who's a wonderful, wonderful guy, he became part of the club. And, you know, it's very easy to look at these military communities as being just one entity being very rigidly military and one being very private. There's a lot of crossover, and it's these people are human. These people are accessible. These people have the same emotions. It's not just the cold, stoic soldier and the grieving spouse. There's a lot of crossover.
One of the things that's remarkable about Lisa Hallett, your main character, not only the depth of her loss because of the quality of her relationship with her husband and her very young family, but also her own resilience. As wounded as she was, she comes across as an incredibly strong person. Let's listen to Lisa in her own words.
We needed something tangible to rally behind. So myself, running was always a way I dealt with things. It was a way many of the other women in the group dealt with things. And they met for the first time in the Burger King parking lot on post, February 2010, about 6 months into the deployment. And there were maybe 9, 12 of us out there. We kind of stood around, we looked at each other, and then we pushed out in a run.
That, for me, Glenn Austin Anderson, was kind of the nut of the whole film. A woman steeped in grief looks out and pushes out on a run.
Absolutely. And, you know, I am running alongside of her through large parts of the film. I'm actually on rollerblades. That's the question I get asked the most about.
I was wondering why the shots are so smooth.
Yeah, I'm on skates next to her skating along. This is my third film about marathon running, so I just went through so many trials and error of trying to figure out the best and smoothest way. And I learned how to skate backwards and learned how to skate with a camera rig on my arm. So I did these runs with her, and it makes you think. It gives you time to both clear your mind and think about the important things. And then we call the film To Remember, and the organization is called Run to Remember. And that's precisely what it is. There's no better time to think. There's no better time to stop and contemplate your future, remember the past fondly, grow as a person than when you're out there, you know, getting that exercise. And, like, it's a very free, liberating thing. And it's a personal thing, but it's also a group thing. And I think that's the story we're trying to tell, that there's hope, there's life, there's joy after loss. And it kind of hit home to me personally. Well, in the post-production on this film, I lost my own brother. So this film has been therapeutic for me, too. And I learned a lot, both as the producer and as someone just observing this community.
Something that really kept me driving forward in the beginning is that my children have lost one parent, and it wouldn't be fair for them to lose a second parent to grief. I am learning that as much as John and I shared a story as John and Lisa Hallett, that I have a story and a life as a woman.
There's a great deal to learn from Lisa Hallett and her reaction and her coping with the loss of her husband and the loss of the father of her children. And it kind of makes me wonder, Glenn, Austin Anderson, you know, you're watching your film and there's no way to escape the idea of numbers. You know, 26.2 is a marathon. There are 41 lost soldiers in this unit. I'll give you one other number, which is 6,603, the number of soldiers, American soldiers lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it strikes me that you could run a lot of miles for those soldiers.
Well, my producing partner is a veteran. He's a U.S. Air Force combat camera veteran. He served over in the Balkans, and the two of us had that exact discussion. There just seems to be a lot of numbers in this film, and when we open the film, we've introduced those numbers, the war dead in Iraq, the war dead in Afghanistan, and we're trying to tell one story or a little bit about the 41 soldiers and see how this impacted one community. But just imagine it on the scale that there's 6,000 families going through this. And we noticed that there weren't a lot of stories about the families. There were a lot of stories about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars out there, but not a lot about the home front. And that's what we tried to tell. It's not just an American story. I think a lot of people around the world can relate to this.
Glenn Austin Anderson is senior producer for BBC News Washington Bureau. He is also the filmmaker behind To Remember, the story of Lisa Hallett, who lost her husband in Afghanistan in 2009. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, earlier in the hour, we asked you how far a dollar or a grand or even $300,000 goes where you live. You, of course, can let us know how you stretch that dollar at home. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can check us out at thetakeaway.org. And always, let us know. And let me know if there's any hope for where I live in Washington, D.C., the worst place in the country, apparently. Thank you so much for listening. Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo. Bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.